Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear reports from Brian Lynn and Dan Novak. Jill Robbins answers a question from our listener, Rebecca, an English teacher in China. We close with an American story. But first, here's Brian Lynn.
Scientists researching climate change in Antarctica are studying penguins in an effort to better understand the area's environmental health. The scientists are measuring the growth and development of the penguin population on the eastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula. Reuters news agency recently reported on studies in the area carried out by two American researchers. "We are counting penguin nests to understand how many penguins are in a colony, producing young every year, and whether that number is going up or down with the environmental conditions," said Alex Borowitz. He is an ecology researcher at New York's Stony Brook University. The work is not easy for climate researchers in the icy, faraway reaches of Antarctica. But penguins are easier to follow than some other kinds of animals because they nest on land. Their black bodies and waste droppings can also be identified against the area's white background. Michael Wethington, another researcher from Stony Brook, told Reuters the penguin population can represent overall climate conditions and the health of the area's whole ecosystem. The researchers say counts of individual penguins can be combined with data from satellite images to get a more complete picture of how the animals are progressing. Gentoo penguins, with bright orange beaks and white markings on their heads, prefer open water without broken pieces of ice floating around. So, when temperatures on the Antarctic Peninsula began rising during the latter half of the 20th century, Gentoo populations moved south. Some scientists called the movement the gentoofication of Antarctica. David Ainley is a biologist with the ecological advisory company H.T. Harvey and Associates. He has been studying penguins for more than 50 years. Gentoo penguins don't like sea ice, Ainley told Reuters. They mostly forage over the continental shelf and don't go far out to sea. As sea ice has decreased along the western side of the peninsula, gentoos seem to have gotten used to the changed conditions. But those same conditions have been worse for the Adelies penguin species. This is because the Adelies depend on sea ice for feeding and reproduction. "When we find Adelie penguins, we typically know that sea ice is nearby," Stony Brook's Wethington said. He added that whenever researchers see sea ice decreasing or disappearing, they also see Adélie penguin populations drop sharply. Even though Adélie penguins are increasing in number overall, some populations have fallen by more than 65%, researchers say. On their January trip to the area, the Stony Brook scientists found that Adélie colonies around the still icy Weddell Sea had remained solid during the past 10 years. This peninsula is maybe a safe space as we see climate change progressing and overall warming throughout the globe, Wethington said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Britain will mark the 70th anniversary of Queen Elizabeth II's rule on Sunday. The 25-year-old Elizabeth became queen on February 6, 1952, following the death of her father, King George VI. She took over a country that survived the damages of World War II, with Winston Churchill as prime minister. Since then, prime ministers, popes, and presidents have come and gone. The Soviet Union has collapsed, and Britain's own empire has disappeared. On June 2, 1953, Elizabeth's coronation was the first event seen on live television by millions around the world. The broadcast brought the British royal family into people's living rooms. Elizabeth then made her first televised Christmas broadcast in 1957, saying she hoped the new medium would make her message more personal and direct. "At least for a few minutes, I welcome you to the peace of my own home," she said at the time. From weddings to funerals, the ceremonies became must-see television. An estimated 750 million people around the world watched the wedding between Prince Charles and Lady Diana on July 29, 1981. A Spaniard reportedly told King Charles I that the sun never sets on the British Empire. Historians estimated the empire once ruled more than 400 million people and had 25% of the Earth's landmass. It was so huge that there was always daylight in one of the territories. Under Elizabeth, Ghana became the first British colony in Africa to celebrate independence in 1957. 3 years later, then-British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan made his famous Winds of Change speech in South Africa. By 1970, most of Britain's African and Caribbean colonies had gained independence, and Britain handed over Hong Kong to China in 1997. The Queen, however, remains the head of state in 15 Commonwealth countries, including Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. Elizabeth's rule has often been compared, good or bad, to the Golden Age of the first Elizabeth in the 16th century. That was a time when England grew its economy, expanded its influence, and celebrated the great William Shakespeare. British historian David Starkey observed that there would be no second Elizabethan age. He said the Queen views her role as simply doing a job. He told Reuters, "I say this not as criticism, but simply as a statement of fact, for she came to the throne with one thought only: to keep the royal show on the road." Anna Whitelock is professor of the history of monarchy at London's City University. She noted, "The definition of success for any monarch over time is to preserve the monarchy and ensure the succession. That is the primary job, and that's what she's done. Matthew Dennison recently wrote a book about the Queen. He said the way Elizabeth performed her role has given her a moral position beyond anything she had as a monarch. Constitutionally, the British monarch now has few practical powers and is expected to be non-political. However, historians say Elizabeth has used soft power and made the monarchy a unifying force for the nation. At the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Queen used her broadcast to calm the public. Former British leaders have said her years of experience have proved of great help. They said they could speak freely without fear of their conversations ever being made public. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair said, "She will assess situations and difficulties and can describe them without ever giving any clue as to political preference or anything like that. It's quite remarkable to see." Some historians say the Queen will be viewed as the last of her kind, a monarch who commands unquestioned respect. And Whitelock observed that she, the Queen, will be up there as one of the greatest monarchs, not just for her longevity, but for the period of change which she has witnessed. I'm Dan Novak.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Rebecca, an English teacher in China. She writes, "I am Rebecca from China. I am also an English teacher for kids. I am confused by the two phrases as follows. 1.
I like summer and winter best.
2.
I like summer and winter most.
Which one is correct? What's the difference grammatically? Thanks, Rebecca in China." Dear Rebecca, thank you for writing to us. At first, I thought the statements sounded incorrect. Then I saw that they may simply be incomplete. Let us begin with best. It is an adverb, a word that describes time, manner, place, or degree. Your grammar book will say it is the superlative form of well. A superlative adverb shows something is to the greatest degree of a quality. Here is an example of best as an adverb.
Yao Ming is best known for his work in the NBA.
The problem I saw was that you said two seasons were better than all the others. Maybe you enjoy swimming and skiing, sports that are not as easy to do outdoors in spring and fall. You can add a phrase to explain this.
Of the four seasons, I like summer and winter best. That's because I can swim in summer and ski in winter.
You could also say,
"For my sports, swimming and skiing, I like summer and winter best."
Now let us look at most. It is also a superlative adverb. It means in or to the greatest degree. You can add some information to your statement about traveling in China to make it clearer.
I like spring and fall most for visiting Hangzhou.
The short answer to your question, Rebecca, is that there is no grammatical difference between your phrases. But make sure your students understand that best and most can also be used as superlative adjectives, as in these examples.
The best seasons for visiting Shanghai are spring and fall. I think the Silk Museum is the most interesting one in Hangzhou.
Note that both of these statements have the before the adjective. That is one easy way to tell the difference between superlative adverbs and adjectives. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
Our story today is called The Exact Science of Matrimony. It was written by O. Henry. Here is Barbara Klein with the story.
Jeff Peters and Andy Tucker could never be trusted. One day, the two men decided to open a marriage business to make some quick and easy money. The first thing they did was to write an advertisement to be published in newspapers. Their advertisement read like this: "A charming widow, beautiful and home-loving, would like to remarry. She is only 32 years old. She has $3,000 in cash and owns valuable property in the country. She would like a poor man with a loving heart. No objection to an older man or to one who is not good-looking. But he needs to be faithful and true, can take care of property, and invest money with good judgment. Give address with details about yourself. Signed, Lonely, care of Peters and Tucker, Agents, Cairo, Illinois." When they finished writing the ad, Jeff Peters said to Andy Tucker, "So far, so good. And now, where is the lady?" Andy gave Jeff an unhappy look. "What does a marriage advertisement have to do with a lady?" he asked. "Now listen," Jeff answered. "You know my rule, Andy. In all illegal activities, we must obey the law in every detail. Something offered for sale must exist. It must be seen. You must be able to produce it. That is how I have kept out of trouble with the police. Now, for this business to work, we must be able to produce a charming widow, with or without the beauty, as advertised." "Well," said Andy, after thinking it over, "it might be better if the United States Post Office should decide to investigate our marriage agency. But where can you hope to find a widow who would waste her time on a marriage proposal that has no marriage in it?" Jeff said that he knew just such a woman. "An old friend of mine, Zeke Trotter," he said, "used to work in a tent show. He made his wife a widow by drinking too much of the wrong kind of alcohol. I used to stop at their house often. I think we can get her to work with us." Mrs. Zeke Trotter lived in a small town not far away. Jeff Peters went out to see her. She was not beautiful and not so young, but she seemed all right to Jeff. "Is this an honest deal you're putting on, Mr. Peters?" she asked when he told her what he wanted.
"Mrs. Trotter," said Jeff, 3,000 men will seek to marry you to get your money and property. What are they prepared to give in exchange? Nothing. Nothing but the bones of a lazy, dishonest, good-for-nothing fortune seeker. We will teach them something. This will be a great moral campaign. Does that satisfy you?
It does, Mr. Peters, she said. But what will my duties be? Do I have to personally reject these 3,000 good-for-nothings you speak of? Or can I throw them out in bunches?
Jeff explained that her job would be easy. She would live in a quiet hotel and have no work to do. He and Andy would take care of all letters and the business end of the plot. But he warned her that some of the men might come to see her in person. Then she would have to meet them face to face and reject them. She would be paid $25 a week and hotel costs.
Give me 5 minutes to get ready, Mrs. Trotter said. Then you can start paying me.
So Jeff took her to the city and put her in a hotel far enough from Jeff and Andy's place to cause no suspicion. Jeff Peters and Andy Tucker were now ready to catch a few fish on the hook. They placed their advertisement in newspapers across the country. They put $2,000 in a bank in Mrs. Trotter's name. They gave her the bank book to show if anyone questioned the honesty of their marriage agency. They were sure that Mrs. Trotter could be trusted and that it was safe to leave the money in her name. Their ad in the newspapers started a flood of letters, more than 100 a day. Jeff and Andy worked 12 hours a day answering them. Most of the men wrote that they had lost their jobs. The world misunderstood them. But they were full of love and other good qualities. Jeff and Andy answered every letter with high praise for the writer. They asked the men to send a photograph and more details. And they told them to include $2 to cover the cost of giving the second letter to the charming widow. Almost all the men sent in the $2 requested. It seemed to be an easy business. Still, Andy and Jeff often spoke about the trouble of cutting open envelopes and taking the money out. A few of the men came in person. Jeff and Andy sent them to Mrs. Trotter, and she did the rest. Soon, Jeff and Andy were receiving about $200 a day. One day, a federal postal inspector came by. But Jeff satisfied him that they were not breaking the law. After about 3 months, Jeff and Andy had collected more than $5,000, and they decided it was time to stop. Some people were beginning to question their honesty, and Mrs. Trotter seemed to have grown tired of her job. Too many men had come to see her, and she did not like that. Jeff went to Mrs. Trotter's hotel to pay her what she was owed, and to say goodbye. He also wanted her to repay the $2,000 that was put into her bank account. When Jeff walked into the room, she was crying, like a child who did not want to go to school. Now,
he said. What's it all about? Somebody hurt you? Are you getting homesick?
No, Mr. Peters, she said. I'll tell you. You were always a good friend of my husband, Zeke. Mr. Peters, I am in love. I just love a man so hard, I can't bear not to get him. He's just the kind I've always had in mind.
Then take him, said Jeff. Does he feel the same way about you?
He does, Mrs. Trotter answered. But there's a problem. He is one of the men who've been coming to see me in answer to your advertisement. And he will not marry me unless I give him the $2,000. His name is William Wilkinson.
Jeff felt sorry for her. He said he would be glad to let her give the $2,000 to Mr. Wilkinson so that she could be happy. But he said he had to talk to his partner about it. Jeff returned to his hotel and discussed it with Andy.
I was expecting something like this, Andy said. You can't trust a woman to stick with you in any plan that involves her emotions.
Jeff said it was a sad thing to think that they were the cause of the breaking of a woman's heart. Andy agreed with him.
I'll tell you what I'm willing to do, said Andy. Jeff, you have always been a man of a soft and generous heart. Perhaps I've been too hard and worldly and suspicious. For once, I will meet you halfway. Go to Mrs. Trotter. Tell her to take the $2,000 out of the bank and give it to this Wilkinson fellow and be happy.
Jeff shook Andy's hand for a long time. Then he went back to Mrs. Trotter. She cried as hard for joy as she had done for sorrow. Two days later, Jeff and Andy prepared to leave town.
Wouldn't you like to go meet Mrs. Trotter once before we leave? Jeff asked Andy. She'd like to express her thanks to you. Why, I guess not, Andy said. I think we should hurry and catch the train.
Jeff was putting all the money they had received in a belt he tied around his body. Then Andy took a large amount of money out of his pocket and asked Jeff to put it together with the other money.
What's this? Jeff asked. It's Mrs. Trotter's $2,000, said Andy. How do you come to have it? Jeff asked. Mrs. Trotter gave it to me, Andy answered. I have been calling on her 3 nights a week for more than a month. Then you are William Wilkinson? Jeff asked. I was, Andy said.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.